Well, once again, it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio, down from the mountaintops, or almost the top of the mountains, not quite, Dan Renshaw. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks, Mike. Blustery day out there. It almost feels like history itself, instead of just a wind and snowstorm.
Yeah, I today, as we're recording this, we're looking at what is supposed to be the tail end of a snowfall, which down here in Palmer has dropped arguably 3 to 4 inches, maybe a bit more. No wind this morning, and then the wind started, and now it's blowing all over the place. What was it like up there started out?
When I left this morning, which would have been about 11 o'clock, had about 6 inches of snow on the porch, no wind.
No wind. Right.
Yeah. Okay. And the problem was I got to the car at the parking lot, and then where's the road? It's such a whiteout. It was a difficult thing.
Wind picked up down from the cabin and the...
No wind. No,
but just
no,
what?
Yeah.
Just
and
snow.
That's usually true of Matanuska winds. We seldom get... we do get an east wind and a severe Matanuska, but we haven't had that recently. So anyway, my plan was to go to town, Anchorage, but I don't think so. I think I better head back as soon as we're done recording here.
Okay. Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
We last left the story by doing some detail. We did a little move off into some detail of how it is that gold actually transforms from being a part of the landscape to be something that is relatively pure and transportable and recognizable, etc.
Right. We had kind of got hung up on some detail describing the bullion mill,
right,
at the bullion mine. You know, and again, the bullion is important in the Willow Creek mining district because it was the first. And I use the word loosely, the first large mine. Mines in those days, large, there was this rule of thumb, I've talked about it before, the number of tons per day that you milled, that number equated to the number of people you had on the property, usually 1 to 1.
Okay.
So at the bullion mine, they finally struggled up to like 40 tons a day, and they had at least that many people scattered around, low camp, high camp, underground, etc. Difficult property to develop, especially in the early days, where they had a cable strung from the mill to a transfer station high on the mountain, and then several smaller cables strung down to the transfer station so that they could bring ore from various sources on the bullion vein,
okay,
and finally get it down to the mill. We were in the milling process of what was it like to try to run a stamp mill in the early days. And we had described the fact that it required a wooden foundation because you've got these big stamps falling as much as 100 times a minute.
Right.
And nothing would stand up to the abuse. There's no way you could reinforce concrete to take that kind of abuse. But they found by putting a foundation of timbers together closely and all of that down to bedrock, that and so all of these timbers are on end, it would take the abuse. It would hold together. And I had mentioned that when you go to the bullion mill site today, you will see these foundations for the stamps.
And remind listeners where that site is.
Don't recall exactly the milepost up Craggy Creek Valley.
Okay.
You would, the road from Craggy Creek Valley comes into the Willow Fishhook Road, right where the very near where the Lucky Shot camp used to be.
Okay.
But the road is in terrible condition. It's not maintained by the state. It is what's called a omnibus road. In other words, the federal government gave it to the state as a finished road at statehood, but the state has not maintained it. So you have to walk quite a ways. But when you get up to a large moraine, I believe it's the first significant moraine you'll come to across the valley floor, you'll see the remnants of the old bullion mill. And I encourage you to go look at it. There's not a lot left. There's a penstock where the water was channeled in. They had a large reservoir trying to extend the period for milling. They had built an elaborate entrapment device for the upper waters of Craigie Creek. And that was all flumed then to the mill where it went through a penstock, and we had mentioned at the bottom of that there was this horizontal device called a Francis turbine.
Right. We talked about that.
Right.
Got that down.
Yeah.
But the interesting word that I might ask for a little bit further description, flume. For the person who's not familiar with flumes, what defines a flume?
Generally, it's a wooden device that you're channeling the water at a minimum grade for just conveyance of the water to from one point to another. There's pictures of some of the mining districts where they did a lot of placer mining where some of these flumes were amazing in their construction just to get the water where you needed it.
Well, I know on the Seward Peninsula outside of Nome, particularly if you go inland from there, there were some there are remnants. You can still see the channels essentially that have built across the hills, carrying water in some cases. And of course, they had the very narrow gauge railroad that also ran through parts of that area.
Right.
That moved. So this is a version of the Roman aqueduct, only not yeah, stone. Right.
Yeah, not quite as durable or elaborate, but same idea. If you can convey water at a minimum grade, like a quarter of a percent fall, you can move a lot of water to get it to a point where you're then elevated sufficiently.
Okay.
That with you can either run a Pelton wheel, a Francis turbine, or in placer mining, you could do a lot of, I hate to use the word, abusing the countryside by sluicing.
Yes, right. And sluicing, I've seen pictures. There are some very interesting photos of what happens when you use the power of water that has been brought that distant, and then it just drops on through the hose, and away you go.
Some of the people that, pardon me. I just had lunch here, Mike, pardon me.
Okay.
Some of the people who got the richest in the California Gold Rush were a group of women who made fire hose.
Oh, okay. A little more about this.
What they early on, they had a source of really durable canvas, probably the same source as Levi had for making his jeans, but they had sewing machines and so on, and they found out there was this huge demand for fire hose, because that was the first method of getting water to a sluice box and doing some initial sluicing of the creeks in California. So there was this wonderful business sprung up on creating fire hose out of canvas.
Right.
And you could roll it up then and ship it out and go to the farthest reaches of the mining district and unroll it and do your sluicing.
Right.
So anyway, there's a long variety of variations to the theme of how you can mobilize water to accomplish this washing. In the Willow Creek District, there was some sluicing done on Grubstake Gulch, but it was rather minor.
Okay.
Most of the water that was organized and used for in the mining process was done in the mills that sprang up around the district.
Okay.
the water, two needs for water. One was the water power in the early days. The second was process water for the milling itself. The milling was done as a wet process.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And nowhere in this Willow Creek area was there dredge work done. Is that correct, or am I?
Not at all. No, that would have been the follow-through on placer mining if there had been sufficient and deep ground that could not have been mined from the surface.
Okay.
Yeah. Dredging, I would separate dredging away. There's hard rock mining, there's placer mining, and there's dredging. It's really a whole another category.
Okay. So we've been talking about some specific mines, and we have spent time talking about some of the detail of how this work was done. Are we about to return to a specific mine?
Where I'm wanting to go is visit the various mines, yes.
Okay.
Saving the Fishhook Creek Valley kind of for last, because that's where most of the people, hopefully the ones that are listening today, are familiar with the visitor center at the Independence Mine.
Right.
Historical park. Probably been there many times, visited. And what I'm wanting to do is kind of save that for the last, to describe when you're there at the visitor center and you're looking at the mountains to the west.
Right.
Skyscraper Mountain and Granite Mountain, all the things that aren't obvious, that it would be wonderful if you knew what you're looking at, because
sure,
there's a multitude of history right in front of you that isn't obvious.
Okay.
But today we have, let me again take you up to the summit of Granite Mountain. We've climbed Granite Mountain. We find up there a plateau. The apex of the triangular plateau becomes what is known as Bullion Ridge or Bullion Mountain, which extends west from the west side of Granite Mountain. About a half a mile from that apex out on that ridgeline, you come to a col known as the Gold Dust Fault, and that is the east extent right there of the Bullion Mine, which we had mentioned was an island vein,
right,
completely eroded away all the way around.
Oh.
But now that we're there and having visited that in this, especially the last session, let's stay over there and let's go on down to Craggy Creek and go down the creek and visit the War Baby and the Lucky Shot Mines, just briefly.
Okay.
The history of those two, and they're down near the mouth of Craggy Creek, where Craggy, let me be more specific, on the road system, when you cross Craggy Creek today at a culvert, not far from there, you'll find the junction with the Craggy Creek Road. When you're standing at that location, you can see a mountain to the north of you that has a lot of activity, a lot of old dump sites on it. One of them that is low on the mountain was so accessible that it was used for road building materials back in the 80s, and unfortunately that dump is gone. It was a really interesting old historic feature, but now it's gone. But that was the War Baby Mine. War Baby, because, and the term was a pejorative, I guess would be the right thing to say. During World War I, there was indeed an influx of children without fathers and so on, and they were generally called war babies. But the idea being that it was a special case, I guess you'd say. Mine found probably in 1917 by Charlie Barthoff. And you'll remember we had talked previously about Charlie and Bill Horning leaving the Gold Cord. They had sold it.
Right.
And moved on. And where they moved to was the War Baby Mine, because Charlie had found that in his prospecting. And they opened it up, and Charlie is the unstoppable prospector. He was constantly looking at a hillside, figuring out where the faults were, and what's that up there, and maybe over here, and if I dug a hole there. And he was so good at what he did. But Charlie found... He understood that there was a fault that had cut off the War Baby vein on the extreme west end of his early development. And in looking at that, he had followed it up quite high on the mountainside, the obvious trace of the fault zone. And he had found up high some float. Now... You're looking for an outcrop of a vein, and because of erosion, you normally have some loose pieces of quartz that have slid down the hill. And if you keep an eye open for the quartz and pick it up and you see that there's color in it, why, you know you can't be too far away from a source, so you keep following it up.
Okay.
And maybe have to do a little digging, and next thing you know, Charlie finds this vein that had been unknown. And this was probably like 1920. They were not too sure on those dates. But we had mentioned that there was an argument about whether they were ptarmigan hunting or not. And there was no need for being way up high on a mountain to find ptarmigan. That's ridiculous. There were flocks of ptarmigan in the multiple hundreds at that time. Down low, you didn't need to be up high. So if the story gets embellished that he shot a ptarmigan and the ptarmigan crawled under a rock and he pulled out a piece of float and therefore finding the Lucky Shot mine. And that story perseveres. So
okay.
The end of it all was that this vein, one of the latter found superior veins. There's a lot of small veins in the mining district that didn't make much in the way of a producing mine. But the particular vein system, it's a shear zone system that is the Lucky Shot, the War Baby, probably the same system as the Bullion Mine. And the piece missing in between, there has been some recent diamond drilling, and they have found parts of it. So I think when they're all done looking, we're going to find that that vein persists for several miles up the valley floor, and there's a lot to come, Mike.
Okay.
I expect that the company that currently has an option on that property, if they can really get their act together and do some meaningful exploration, I'm quite confident they're going to find some really outstanding resource.
Well, that brings up an interesting question, perhaps, at this moment in time. If we pause with the history and say, sounds as if there's action in this area still today, certainly not at the level that appeared back in the 20s or earlier periods. How would you just briefly describe what is being done throughout that area in terms of seeking out and producing gold?
Today, and literally today, there is a lot of interest in doing some what I would call second-tier prospecting. The first prospecting that was done was almost laughable in its simplicity. You just happened to be in the right place, the right time to look down and see an outcrop, and it made a mine. I mean, it wasn't a case of having to do a lot of extensive work.
Right.
Certainly that was the case of all of the mines that developed from west to east. You had the Fern Mine, the Mabel Mine. You had the what became the Independence Mine. On two different levels, you've got the Martin Mine, the Bullion. All of them had one thing in common. They were all found at an easily accessible outcrop. well, what's the chance that's all there is? Well, I'd say there's a lot more where it came from, but you need to do a little extra. And the extra that's been done recently is some diamond drilling. Now, for those not familiar, this is like cutting donut holes, let's say, because the donut would be the bit, and mm-hmm. it's hollow. Okay. And as it cuts by rotating, diamond-faced, it is actually cutting a core that fills a core barrel inside of the drilling apparatus. This core then is removed and can be evaluated. And that's what's taking place now, and it has in the past. A company in particular, calling themselves Full Metal Minerals, a Vancouver-based company, came in, did a lot of basic exploration. I got to be careful. I have an audience of a geologist here, but I have to say that geologists sometimes are very good at the big picture mm-hmm. and very poor in details. And Full Metal Minerals was that way. They were wonderful in locating drill holes and following through with a drill pattern. But the detail work was in the devil in the detail was the paperwork necessary to secure their hold on the property. So they're all done. They found some wonderful, wonderful things, but they had to move on because they hadn't taken care of the paperwork.
Oh.
It was a tragedy. Oh. But anyway, the information gained stayed with the property, and now right. it's in another set of hands. And with a little luck, it'll be really interesting to see if this group then will follow through on A, more prospecting, and B, some additional mining. But the Lucky Shot mine has a lot of resources left in it. And that'll probably be the initial focus for mining.
Okay. So the independence, well, later on we'll talk about potentials at any other place, but right now you're talking specifically of the Lucky Shot mine.
The Lucky Shot was where Full Metal Minerals did the majority of their, what would I call it, better drilling, their more productive drilling, the drilling that proved up some meaningful resource and reserves.
You know, the other question that also pops into my mind has to do with how the mining of gold is occurring around the world. I'm going to guess that when the mining, particularly in the periods you've described, was happening, there was a certain level of interest in having gold. Population of the world has increased. The technology requirements, perhaps, for gold have increased. And Alaska had a certain place. Today, where does Alaska sit in the world of mining for gold?
Well, I should have that number in front of me, but I apologize I don't. It is a very critical player. There's a lot of gold being produced in Alaska.
Okay.
The Fort Knox mine in Fairbanks, the Pogo mine down in the Delta area. A lot of placer mines, small, you put them together and they're a significant production. There's a lot, but it's not the major producer in the United States. I believe Nevada still has that place.
Okay.
We're at an interesting point right now, Mike, with current gold production. Gold made it up to just under $2,000 an ounce a few years ago, and then stabilized, apparently, everybody believed, it was going to stabilize around $1,700. Several things happened. The China, well, they can't call it a meltdown, the China change in the way they were doing things. The dollar became very strong relative to other currencies. A bunch of these factors all work together that currently, right now, As we reach the end of 2015, there is a collapse of commodities. All the metals, and including the platinum group and silver and gold, they're all terribly depressed. Probably, it looks very likely that gold will go under $1,000 an ounce.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's quite a change.
Quite a change from a few years ago. Well, what happened, all this enthusiasm that comes with high prices, you had a lot of the major companies that produce gold taking on a lot of debt in expanding and buying and bringing new properties onto market. Well, today there's a lot of red faces because their choices really weren't that good. And boy, some of these companies are in terrible, terrible straits. There's an oddity to gold. Micah warned me here as we're, I don't want to run out of time.
We have about 3 minutes. So
okay.
You can do it, the oddity in three.
Let's give me give you this odd thing about gold. Gold primarily is produced in a milling process. You bring the ore up or down from wherever it's being mined, and you run it through a mill, and the mill's running 24/7. So it's got a throughput capacity.
Okay.
Now, you're a gold miner, you're in business, you've got to sell the gold you're producing because that's how you keep going. You've got a resource base that's broken down into different reserve categories, proven, probable, possible, etc. As the price of gold goes down, oddly, the amount of gold on the market goes up because they're mining higher grade. So when it was 2,000 an ounce, why the amount of gold was very depressed that was coming out of the mine. Today, it's twice that much out of the same mill because they're having to mine their higher grade material.
Okay.
This is a very odd thing because as there's a general decline in gold, more coming on the market means that it's even a more declining market. And because there's just not enough people out there buying it, even though more is coming on. So it's a very, very difficult time for gold mining right now.
Okay. And maybe that marks a place where we can end this particular session. It's amazing how quickly we...
it goes by so fast.
...to this time.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting point, at least at this time here toward the end of 2015, because I'm guessing that throughout the history of this mining district and mining for gold in general, that price of gold has dramatically impacted how many people would spend what kind of energy to get to that goal.
Yeah, it's a very complex thing. Yes.
Okay, well, we'll pick that up in our next session. I want to thank Dan Renshaw once again for coming in. And
thank you, Mike.
And talking.